you tell us a bit about how this assignment came about? Who approached you on the Willis, on the Kaiser Frazier consultants?
George Harbert, the chief engineer of Kaiser.
H-A-R-B-E-R-T,
yeah, Harbert.
And he was the one who recommended you?
He knew Buzz from the time that Buzz had worked at Kaiser out there.
Of course, okay.
And so he called because of that. Mm-hmm. And so we, at the same time, Dutch Darren was also working out there as a consultant.
Yes.
And he had a studio right on the other side of a partition from us.
Oh, yes.
And he and his crew were working over there, and we were working on our side of the fence. On this new Willys facelift for the front end and rear end.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, they had given up on the Kaiser. They figured that the Kaiser was not going to be,
really?
And we stopped work on that. But we were working on the Willys, and Dutch Darren and Duncan McRae were working on their.
Duncan McRae.
Yeah. Do you know him?
Unfortunately, I don't.
Yeah, he died,
right.
Unfortunately, last year.
Him.
Yeah, nice guy.
That's what I hear.
So we, both of us made a full-size presentation on the facelifting job.
Uh-huh.
And they decided that they didn't have the money to go ahead with a full scale facelifting,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to throttle back and just do a little bit on the present on the 54 Willys,
mm-hmm.
Just a molding change and a tail light change or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't do any more work on the project. They had Darren do that on the 50. It turned out to be the 55 Willys. And they did a side molding treatment and a taillight treatment. That's all that was on that.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing much came of that whole project, but we were working on both the Kaiser and the Willys project for about a year.
Mm-hmm. A lucrative contract.
Yes, it worked out very well. And then about the time that was winding down, I got a call from Frank Hershey who was chief stylist for Ford Division at that time.
Now, when was the last time you had a contact with him?
Just recently?
No, prior to this.
Oh, not since the GM days.
That's right, that'd been about at least 15 years, hadn't it?
Yeah, 1934 and 35 to
almost 20.
55, yeah.
About 20 years.
Yeah.
Did you ever ask him, you can develop this, as
what yeah.
happened? You got a call from him.
And
he
said that he had would like to have me come out to Dearborn to had a proposition to talk to me about, and I thought it was another consulting job.
Mm-hmm.
So
had you seen him?
No, hadn't seen him or talked to him.
Yeah.
No, and
you're probably too modest to say so, but you've impressed these people as your career with your talents, and that they remember you.
Well, in that business, you get to be known around, you know.
Sure. Yeah, uh-huh.
Everybody knows everybody else pretty much, even
yeah.
if you don't know them, you know the names,
you know
what, and you hear what they're doing here.
Right.
And
yeah.
He probably heard that we were working on the Continental thing, mm-hmm. and that he knew that was over or something,
mm-hmm.
you know, his
yeah.
guy that's loose at this time or something. And mm-hmm. anyway, he was looking for somebody to be manager of the Thunderbird studio. So I went out and we talked about it, and he laid the whole thing out. But the styling section was expanding at that time,
mm-hmm.
and they were looking for the right kind of people for these different jobs, and would I be interested in this? So I said, yes, I would. It sounded good to me, but I was in business and I had a partner, and I didn't want to.
Right.
Jump out of that without consulting my partner.
You must have known Buzz also, at least by reputation.
Probably
yeah.
did.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, I'll let you know in a couple of days. So I went back, and Buzz and I talked it over, and Buzz says, gee, this is a good opportunity. He says, go ahead. He says, why don't you go out there and get that? And he said, maybe you get out there, maybe there'll be something for me out there, too. And so he said, take it, you know, because we weren't doing much at the time. It was the end of the Kaiser thing, and we were doing some, a little overflow work from Sundberg and Farrar design.
For the body designs.
Yeah. And so... I started in out of Ford and the Thunderbird, and the when I took over, we were down in the basement in the wash rack. That was my studio.
Now, who was involved with the Thunderbird studio at that time? Who were your cohorts?
John Middleton was my assistant manager.
Was he?
Middleton. Is this Middleton or
Middlestead?
Middlestead, John.
Yes,
Middlestead.
Right.
Had two. There was John Middlestead. The way they set it up shortly after I got there was that you were retired, you weren't manager anymore, you were executive status, because you were on the same level as executive engineer. They were for engineering. They were trying to balance selling and engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yeah.
So you're on the same level as executive engineer. So the executive status, and under this executive status were two managers. There was manager for exterior and manager for interior.
Right. And which was,
Middlestead was exterior, and God, I can't remember interior. As a matter of fact, that didn't happen until I got in Ford Advanced. Now, while I was in Thunderbird, I'll have to retract it a little bit here. I went into Thunderbird. As manager, and we didn't have any exterior or interior, and I didn't have any assistant managers.
Yeah.
And I say we didn't have a studio proper. The Thunderbird had, the 55 had just kind of evolved, and Frank Hershey was involved in that, and it was kind of a stepchild. They didn't know what the hell to do with it, really. That GM has a Corvette, we've got to have something. So they will hang on to this and build a few of them, see what happens. But they didn't attach too much importance to it, really. And so.
Did you work on any design?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we did they were at a crash program for the 56. The 56 had to be designed. And so we started out in the wash rack downstairs. In the styling studio, in the building, because we didn't have a studio yet. And there was no space for us, and they were just expanding all over the place. So I had about maybe six or seven fellows designers working for me, and about three clay modelers, and a full-size car down there that we were reworking for 56, toward the back end off and the front end of. And that's when we put on the rear bumper with the exhausts in it, and the spare tire.
Right.
Had to get the tire out of the trunk because we were getting a lot of complaints from the field that people couldn't get the golf clubs in the deck. Spare tire had to come out, so we had to come up with that workout, which we did in an awful hurry.
Yeah.
And a new interior design, which one of the fellows that worked for me did. Was his name Jimmy Quinlan.
Jim Quinlan, yeah.
Jimmy
did
that.
He's remained in interiors all these years. Yeah.
Well, here's where he started out, in the wash rack down there with me.
Yeah.
And I hired him, and he did that interior for the 56 Bird. And then...
Who decided on the porthole?
The portholes, I don't know, because that was already being kicked around at that time. On the 55, they were figuring on putting
the
portholes.
Someone said Louis Crusoe, that was one of his.
Maybe.
Yeah.
We worked out all kinds of windows in that thing, portholes and rectangular windows, and windows that followed the top line, and went through dozens of workouts, but ended up as a porthole line.
Was Bill Boyer still working with you on that?
Bill was, he wasn't on that, no. No,
right. No,
he was working for, I believe, Bob Wagner at the time.
Oh, okay.
Truck.
Yeah.
Anyway, we did the 56 in a big hurry, and then they jumped right ahead to have the 57. 57, we could change the rear end sheet metal on that and put the tire inside, back inside again. So we did that. We worked out the rear end and did some work on the front grille. And that was the 57, which turned out to be a pretty successful car.
Yeah. Even better than the original, I think.
Yeah. It's the collectors like it better.
Right, yeah. Now the idea of putting that rear tire, enclosing the rear tire and putting it on a classy emblem, that was great.
It worked out pretty good.
Yeah.
So then we started on the four place. They wanted a four place.
Oh, yeah.
Which I objected to.
Their first mistake.
I tried to talk them out
really?
Of that. Yeah. I wanted them to, if they had to have a four place, they had the tooling for the two place, keep the two place, still build a two place, give
right.
people a choice. They wanted a four place. They said, well, family, you got to have a place for the kids and the, you know, Mark. Okay.
Yeah.
Those that want it, buy a four place.
Well,
those that want the two place, you have a two place.
What
oh, no. Got to be one or the other.
They
we can't afford
buy,
we can't afford two cars. Mm-hmm. So they made a mistake there, I think. So, anyway, that time, then we moved upstairs into the main floor section of the building, set up the T-Bird studio, and about that time they said, "Well, we want you to take over Ford Advance car," and I was just getting interested in the T-Bird, getting started, and they were always playing musical chairs, you know. So. Okay, so I took over the Ford Advance car, and then that's when they changed the titles, the executive status, and they had two managers under you and a bigger crew.
Was that Bordenay doing all that juggling, trying to get parity with the engineering department? Or was it George Walker?
I guess it was George Walker. Bordenay was a
studio chief.
Yeah, he was a executive status for Lincoln Mercury at the time.
Yeah.
So. We started on the four place T-Bird. We just got started. So they switched me into the Ford Advance car, and we started work on advanced cars. And about 6 months of that, and constant shows. We had weekly shows that would just drive you out of your mind.
Most people have complained about that compulsive habit of Ford. Throwing everything into Thursday and to get ready for Friday.
That's right.
And lots of overtime.
Oh, overtime! I worked 6 days, 7 days a week.
Incredible.
Rarely a 5 days. I don't know of any time I worked 5 days when I was there. And and nights on top of that.
Yeah, okay.
We used to eat over at the restaurant and the hotel and the
Dearborn Inn.
Dearborn Inn.
Yeah, that's
there.
Right. Yeah, still there.
And have wonderful. Lobster tails.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was about $1.25 or
yeah,
something
right.
like that. You know?
About
the drawn
bucks.
Butter and everything.
Oh,
oh God. And you had a tab over there, you just signed it, you know. And I was eating over there every night. And but anyway, I got a call one day from Tom Bannister at Chrysler.
Oh, no.
And Tom was in charge of chief stylist for Chrysler and DeSoto.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to know if I want to make a change. And I was just about overtimed out about the time.
Bad, yeah.
And
did you buzz over in the interim, by the way?
Oh, yes. And then, well, after I got into T-Bird, then Frank wanted to know if my partner would want to come over to Ford. So I called Buzz, and Buzz came out and talked to Frank, and Frank hired him. While I was on the wash rack on the T-Birds,
mm-hmm.
Buzz was hired, and they didn't have anything for him to do.
Uh-huh.
And so he would come down there and sit in my studio and watch us work. And this went on for, I don't know, about a month. They didn't have a spot for him, but they hired him.
Yeah.
At that time, they were just going out and getting everybody.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know. Yeah. So finally, they came up with a spot for him, and it was Mercury, manager of Mercury Design.
Oh.
I think it was Mercury Advanced car.
Oh.
And I had Ford Advanced, he had Mercury there.
Mm-hmm.
And so he stayed on, you know, Buzz's story. It was turned out very, very well for him. In the meantime, Tom Bannister called me, Chrysler, and so I went over to see Exeter. He set up an appointment. I went over to see Exeter, and I was hired by Exner to do the small car project. They wanted to bring out a small car.
I've not heard this before. What kind of small car were they thinking of?
Well, about a 105 inch wheelbase car right in there.
Yeah.
And nobody else was working on it, and so I guess they decided there was some place in the market for it.
And this was in 1956?
Yeah.
Hmm.
So I started on that, and Herb Weisinger then had come back to Chrysler in the meantime. He had been away, he'd been out at Kaiser Fraser.
Oh, okay.
And he had Buzz, and then he came back to Chrysler. So Herb and I had this small car project, kind of co-managers, co-partners on it. And we had a crew in there, designers and models. And we worked on that. I don't know how many months that was, but the latter part of 56. In the meantime, Frank Hershey had left Ford and had gotten a job with Kaiser Aluminum and was setting up an industrial design department for Kaiser Aluminum. Reynolds Aluminum had a similar situation.
I take it the small car design project died a boring.
It was still gone when I left.
Was it still gone.
Nothing ever came of it.
No. Well,
and
in 56, Elwood Engel. No, he hadn't come in yet.
No, Exner was still there, yeah.
Tell us a bit about Exner. What kind of personality did he have? What kind of drive did he have?
Well, he was a real automobile man. He did some good things and he did some strange things.
What were some of each?
Well, I think that the Chrysler, all the Chrysler cars in 1957, that was the first year of the fins, not the first year, but the pronounced fins.
Culmination.
But those were all good-looking cars for their day. I think they were the best-looking cars on the road. And X was responsible for those. He headed up that whole drive for that particular type of car.
Mm-hmm.
That 57, the whole line was very good. Ford was very good that year. They had the fins too. Everybody was going fin crazy, but the Chrysler line was very good. Then after that, for some reason or other, it started to go downhill, and I don't know what happened to X's taste or direction or whatever it was, but it got weird. It got into some real strange. The 59 and 60 cars were very strange. And I think that's, then their sales began to fall off, and I think that's what caused his departure from Chrysler.
Well, Exner stayed on for at least another 6 or 7 years.
Well, he stayed until about 62, I guess, 63, right in there, yeah. Something like that.
What kind of a person was he? Was he a nice guy?
Oh, yeah, wonderful fellow.
Did he live up to his reputation, pretty much?
Yeah, he, and a lot of talent. He did some strange things.
What were some strange things?
Well, like those, these 59 and 60 cars that they put out. Real weird shapes on the Dodge and the Plymouth. Strange looking sculptures. Everything overdone, over life size, you know. Huge headlamp bezels and strange-looking sculptured sides of the cars and all.
Mm-hmm.
But
was this viewed as a retrogression at the time?
Yeah, I think. Well, it was a strange period. I kind of lost interest in automobile design about that time because it was getting awful strange now. Everybody was getting strange. Ford, when I was there. Wanted the weirder the better. The cars got to be cartoons. Not you didn't design these kids that sit down in there and they're supposed to be designing cars. They look like funny paper cartoons. Huge wings and fins and bombs and that kind of stuff. And I just got to the point where I didn't have any interest in this stuff anymore. And so when I got this call from Frank Hershey and he was setting up this design department in Oakland, California, and I there's an opportunity to get back to California too. It sounded good to me because I'd get away from these funny cars that they were doing in the late 50s. And I just ran out of gas as far as I just didn't agree with the philosophy of design at that time. Too much, everything was overdone. So I came out here and started to work with Frank, and we set up a nice industrial design department. Nice group of guys, all very talented. Most of them Art Center boys. And I had automotive and transportation. I worked on making automotive presentations to Detroit and making up designs and brochures and presenting them to the different styling departments. And Frank and I would go back and make these pitches to Ford and Chrysler and so on, trying to emphasize aluminum, get more usage of aluminum in cars. And then I worked a lot in the boat industry in the same way, trying to promote aluminum usage in the marine industry. And then did a lot of mobile home work, promotion.
I may have missed it, but did the industrial design department go anywhere?
Well, it did for a while. We started in about 1956, and I left there in 63, so I was there about 7 years, about seven years, I guess, 56, yeah, about 7 years. As I say, it was very interesting. We worked with Kaiser customers and we were being well received. But then there was a recession in the business, and Kaiser had to cut back, and they started cutting back on staff. And we had a staff of about 10 people at one time, and they cut it almost in half.
Oh.
And then I left there in 63, and Frank stayed on a couple of more years, I guess, and then he left, and the department just kind of dwindled away. It ended up with one man in it, and he stayed right from the beginning, from 56 until just about 3 years ago, and he retired.
Who's that?
Jim Dong. What? Jim Dong, a Chinese fellow from the Art Center.
D-O-N-G?
Art Center,
D-O-N-G. Yeah, I remember.
He's
become quite famous. In terms of public showings.
Well, he's worked with Kaiser Aluminum ever since then.
Well, here, not in Detroit.
No, out here.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm mistaken.
Maybe a different one. But anyway, the whole thing just kind of started to disintegrate, and finally ended up with him retiring about 3 years ago. But I formed with two other fellows, ex-Kaiser fellows that worked with me there at Kaiser. We formed our own design office in Oakland. And I still worked for Kaiser. I had a Kaiser automotive sales office in Detroit. I did a lot of promotion work for them.
Did you?
Going back there and making pitches and doing design work for them.
Of course, they were branching out incredibly in all directions, weren't they, in terms of transportation?
Yeah.
Consumer transportation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at the same time, John Reinhart was doing the same thing for U.S. Steel. He had left Ford and was heading up the U.S. Steel department, just like the Kaiser department, and he had this Sid Mead working for him doing U.S. Steel promotion brochures.
Futuristic cars. Futuristic.
Yeah, right. And
Sid Mead's still around Los Angeles?
I guess he is, yeah. He's quite a guy.
Can I interrupt you for a moment? Tell us a little bit about in 57, the Kaiser Aluminum Chemical Corporation. This this incredible array of consumer products that you worked on, some of the details of what you what they were putting out in those days.
Well, when I worked with Kaiser in 57, they, as I said, they had 23 companies, something like that. Mm-hmm. And they were into automobiles, aluminum, steel, cement, packaging, aluminum foil division, shipping.
The remnants of the other Kaiser's empire.
Yes. Electronics,
they
had electronic division.
Mobile homes.
Yeah, but they weren't manufacturing mobile homes. They were supplying material to mobile home manufacturers.
Okay, yeah. Like that big one, what's it called? The one that almost went under.
Winnebago?
Yeah, Winnebago, yeah.
Well, they sold all of them. It was an open market. But I said they had many companies, and it was a very vital organization. And
the old man at this point was still involved with running the company.
Yes.
Henry J.
Yeah, he died, I think, about 70.
That long? I think just that long.
Yeah. And
having dug up his automobile companies,
yes. Well, they still had Willys when he died.
Yeah.
They sold off Willys to American Motors, though.
Unfortunately. The Jeep product.
They discontinued the automobile line when they left Detroit, when they left Willow Run in 55. They sent the dyes down to South America. You know,
that's right.
Down to Argentina. And
manufactured them for years.
Manufactured the Kaiser Carabella, yeah, mm-hmm. for about 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I guess the dyes wore out, and the whole system wore out, and the political situation down there changed. And so they discontinued operations down there too, and that got them out of the passenger car business. They were left then with the Jeep, and then they sold Jeep to American Motors. I don't know when it was, 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's still a big company, and they I enjoyed my years with them. It was fun, and it was something different. It gave me a chance to get away from automobiles, doing automobiles just completely. I did just enough for promotional work in Detroit, which kept me in it, but still I wasn't involved in the everyday production design. And so I enjoyed it. But then in our industrial design office that we set up, I still did continue with Kaiser as a client,
mm-hmm.
and doing promotional work for their automotive division, sales division in Detroit. And I did that. We had our office until about 1970,
71,
and then...
You mentioned our offices. By this time, Buzz is no longer with you. Who is...
I formed this office with these two fellows that I had worked with at Kaiser.
You mentioned
with
one.
Grabe Smith.
Who was that?
Grabe Smith.
I suppose first name.
Grabe Smith. And... and Ed Chan, Chan.
Oh, I see. They had. How'd that come about? How'd the partnership come about?
Well, Grabe Smith. So when I worked with him at Kaiser, had the that's in charge of container and packaging part of Kaiser Design.
Yeah.
And Ed Chan worked for him.
Uh-huh.
But it was all under Frank Hershey, and I was Frank Hershey's assistant manager.
I see.
And so then we left and formed our own office.
Frank got around, didn't he?
Yes, yes. Frank left the Kaiser about 1965, I think it was, something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, Grabe and Ed and I had our office. I stayed in the office until about 1970.
Well, that the consultancy, or rather the assistant managership in the industrial design department of Kaiser Lumen lasted for a number of years, didn't it? About,
yeah,
almost 10
about,
years.
Yeah,
almost, 10
years. Well, let's see, 57, 3, about 6, 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say about 7 years.
And it came to an end with Hershey's departure, or had you?
No, I left before Frank did.
You did, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Why'd you leave, remember?
Well, we formed our own design office.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Ed Chan and Grabe Smith and I.
Mm-hmm.
And then
you decided to take advantage of the explosion in industrial design.
Yeah, there was activity in. In industrial design at that time, a little more activity happening, and then I had the Kaiser account. I took that with me as far as the sales division
oh,
in Detroit.
Did.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
And Grabe and Ed concentrated on packaging design, and they took Kaiser packaging with them.
Uh-huh.
So we were doing practically the same thing we were doing working for Kaiser, only we were at our own office.
And where was that?
In Oakland, Jack London Square.
Mm-hmm.
And
Oakland has been traditionally the main headquarters, the West Coast for headquarters of the Kaiser.
Headquarters for Kaiser, right.
I mean, Kaiser.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The cement plants are around here.
Yeah, Edge Cement is, is Permanente plant is down here, down the peninsula.
The steel is?
The steel was in Fontana.
Fontana, uh-huh.
The
aluminum was?
Aluminum, they have plants all over the country.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe 6 or 8 plants around.
I wonder why it came out to the Bay Area. Was there a conscious decision to come out here?
No, Henry Kaiser always worked on the West Coast.
He did.
He was West
not
Coast
New Orleans,
man.
As is probably supposed, with the ship company.
No, he built his ships right here in Richmond.
Oh, Richmond, oh, okay.
Yeah, the Liberty ships that he built right here in Richmond during the war. Yeah.
This was his main area.
Right.
Yeah. He started here.
He started in up around Seattle and as a road building contractor.
Oh, really?
And then he started doing some government work, and he built Grand Coulee Dam.
Did he really?
He built, which is Boulder Dam.
Boulder
Dam.
Right.
And then a big dam up in Washington. So that's where he got his start here on the West Coast. Then the war came along, and he, of course, built the Liberty ships. And
he convinced him that he could do it his way.
Oh yeah.
Which was an assembly line technique.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything with him was assembly line. He figured everything could be done in assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
And everything worked for him except his cars.
Oh dear.
But
you hung on to those lucrative sales and packaging contracts.
Right, right, Kaiser. So that gave us a good start.
Yeah.
And then a little later on, I developed a line of office equipment, office accessories.
What were they?
Desk trays and desk pads, pen. Pen holders, notebook dispensers, desk pads, writing pads, waste baskets, clock. There's a clock that's designed to produce that. Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Yes.
That's made out of one piece of aluminum extrusion.
I see.
That's just one extrusion.
Is this the model, or is this one special in the diffuser?
No, that's the production model. That's the production.
And who made the works for you?
Westcock. Westcock.
Oh, okay, good. Oh, there you are. That's your logo.
Designer's Products, yeah.
Yeah, what's it called?
Designer's Products.
Yeah. That was the, that was your...
That was separate from the design office.
Oh, I see. Okay. Did this go very well?
Oh, yeah, we sold several thousand of them.
I'll bet you did. Yeah. Yeah.
And I sold a lot to Kaiser Aluminum as gifts, for executive gifts, promotional gifts.
Sure.
See, this is all aluminum, and they have the little... There's your
works
in there.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This is held on by a magnet there.
Oh.
The only steel on it is this back piece. That's steel. That's held on by a magnet. But that is all one piece of aluminum.
That's incredible. Who manufactured that for you?
Kaiser?
In their
Dalton, Illinois extrusion plant. And then the extrusion was sent up out here, and I had a job shop that would cut them to size and anodize them first in 15-foot lengths, and then chop them, cut them. And then I set up a little shop and had some people working and to assemble all these things.
Oh, great.
And
that's
so
very handsome.
We had them sold, and a lot of the best stores, Gump's in San Francisco carried them, Neiman Marcus in Dallas carried them.
What'd they go for?
Originally $40.
In audio terms, can you explain this so that it would be explicable on tape what we're looking at?
Well, it's a desk clock, approximately 4 inches high and about 7 inches wide,
mm-hmm.
and about inch and three quarters deep.
Mm-hmm.
It's made from one piece aluminum extrusion, and as I said, that it's anodized in 12-foot lengths in a dark brown architectural color, or some of them we had anodized in the polished aluminum. And I had the faces stamped out and bought the movements from Westcock and set up a shop and had them assembled. And then I had contacted reps that sold for me, and we sold it in New York and Florida and Southern California, Washington, Oregon, Arizona.
Well, striking thing of it is the face. Can you describe the face? Rather, I think, advanced for its time.
Yeah, the face is plastic. It's imitation wood grain. It's a vinyl wood grain with a rosewood grain,
mm-hmm.
and the hands and the markings, face markings are white against the rosewood background, and
there are dots instead of numerals.
Yes, uh-huh.
Which gives it a striking, and the hands themselves are different in shape, differentiate between the hour and the minute hand, and very modern in looks.
Yeah, it was very well received by everybody that bought them. The only thing is that it got to be involved when you're a designer and trying to be a manufacturer and everything. You're just trying to wear too many hats. It gets too involved.
Does it?
You get in, mix up incredible problems, business-wise, so I had this line and sold it for about 4 or 5 years, and I concentrated too much time on that, not enough to in my design business, but I gradually phased it out and opted for a little more leisurely type of existence, which was freelance design. And I ended up by...
Well, you and your partners prospered, obviously.
Yes, it is.
The company from 65 on.
Yes, it... Grabe Smith has carried on, and the office is still in operation.
Really?
I left the office, and so did Ed Chan. He went to Hong Kong working for another company. Uh-huh. I got overly involved in the office accessory business.
Uh-huh.
Grabe Smith still has the office and is carrying on today.
But the partnership has been dissolved.
Oh, yes.
Do you see him from time to time?
Yes.
Talk with you from time to time on various...
Still in the area. Both of them are still in the area now, and we see each other quite regularly.
Mm-hmm.
But
by 1970, you'd
wanted to... about 71.
Uh-huh.
And so then I started freelancing, and answered an ad for an interior airplane designer for World Airways.
Oh, really? A small West Coast outfit? Or?
Yeah, it's World Airways. It goes out of Oakland Airport here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're international outfit.
Oh, they are?
Yeah. And well, they were then, too. They fly DC-10s and DC-8s and 747.
Oh,
yeah. That's good little airline.
Mm-hmm.
And
they wanted to upgrade their cabin.
Well,
interiors.
Dave Bell had started a design section in their modification facility.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to have a complete service. They wanted to, when they hit in the airplane business, they have they call them modification centers.
Mm-hmm.
Where they will take other airlines' airplanes in, they will overhaul them, they'll paint them, like a big shop,
mm-hmm.
repair shop for
yeah.
only for airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
They install new engines. They install fuel tanks, extra fuel tanks. They can remodify a whole airplane. And they wanted to offer interior service as well for executive airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
So Dave Bell, who had been doing this type of work with a company down in Los Angeles, came up here and joined World Airways, and he advertised for a designer. And I was freelancing, and I answered the ad, and Dave and I started to work together at World Airways.
Tell us a bit about Dave Bell's background. What was his?
He was a pilot in early stages of the Vietnam War. He was an Art Center graduate. Then after got out of the Air Force, he went to work for a company in Los Angeles whose name escapes me right now. It's a big mod center down there, the biggest one in the country. I can't think of it. Can't think of it right now. Anyway, he worked for this mod center for several years.
When you say mod, what do you mean by that?
Modification center.
Oh, okay. Was there a particular jargon in the design business to do modification for someone else?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Modifying airplanes, it means repairing or rebuilding or building.
Refurbishing.
In fact, this company that he worked for did Ford executive airplanes.
Really?
Yeah.
So
their interiors. And I can't think of the name right now. Amazing. But anyway, Dave, I worked for them for several years, then came up and formed this interior operation at World Airways.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with him there. And We did two airplanes for the Italian government, two DC-9s, new DC-9s, for the for their Navy, for Navy brass. And then we did a couple of a 1727, 1720 interior.
I came out from Denver in a 727.
No, did you?
I think so.
Yeah. Probably did.
Yeah, very comfortable.
Yeah. And then Dave wanted to open his own office. And the modification business didn't turn out to be as lucrative for World Airways as they thought it was going to be. So they decided they wanted to phase it out. So Dave opened his own office, and he has a lot of contacts in the airplane business. And so I've been working with him off and on for about, since 1974, I guess.
Really?
Yeah. And,
you answered an ad that he placed in the paper.
Yeah.
And you went to see him, and what happened?
Well, I went to airplane interior design designer, and I had had experience in that particular thing, and there aren't too many people around with that kind of experience. So it was kind of a natural thing. And so since about 1975, I have been working with him on a part-time basis. I've sort of officially retired by 1975. And I worked with Dave maybe on two or three jobs a year.
Has it worked out to your satisfaction?
Yes, just right.
Just right. Huh?
Because I haven't wanted to work full time, and but I do like to do something once in a while.
Right.
But I don't want to be tied to a job.
Yeah.
I want to feel that I am retired, and this gives me that opportunity. So I've spent that the last 10 years. Restoring cars and working on airplanes and landscaping my house.
Yeah, well, you've certainly done a marvelous job on all of it. What type of airplanes, interiors, have you worked on in the last few years since you're still in service?
Where's that little brochure I gave you out?
Ah, yes.
This is just a few of them that we've worked on. One of these airplanes is a 7. Let's see, which one is the? Yeah, here's a Boeing 720 interior. This is for Kurt Kerkorian, the international oil man.
And motion picture.
Yeah, motion picture, owns MGM.
Yeah, that's right.
All that.
Yeah.
This is his airplane here. This one. And
what distinctive features did you come up with for him? What type of, if you can describe them in audio terms.
Well, the airplane like that has a complete interior, has a bedroom, has a shower, and has a conference room, has a bar, has a lounge, has a television. It has all the comforts of home in it.
However, did you rig up a shower in an airplane? How was that
done? Well, the engineers work it out. They have water that's pumped through the system when you turn it on.
Oh,
yeah.
Where would you get enough pressure to? Would you pump a normal shower?
Well, I don't know exactly how it's done, but it's done quite regularly.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah.
I think Jake is very good.
Yeah, right. On the large ones like this, on the 720s, 727s. Then we've done a lot of work on G3s, G2s, that's Gulfstream. Gulfstream 2s and 3s.
Chrysler just picked them up.
Have they?
About 6 months ago, yeah. Lee Iacocca. But they bought them out completely.
They
added them to their corporate stable. And Lee Iacocca is still number 3 on the list. He can't get an executive jet.
Oh, really?
He complained that he couldn't get, he had to wait in line for his own jet.
Oh, I'll be darned. I'll be darned. Yeah, we did a G3 for Coca-Cola Company, owned for Seagram's. This one here is a Challenger concept for Arkansas Modification Center.
When you say Challenger concept, what is that?
The Challenger, this... airplane is a projected airplane. I mean, they're working on it. This is a projected interior for it.
Mm-hmm. What were your specialties? Was it leather pretty much? Or?
Oh no, you have not very much leather is used in the in the executive airplanes.
Why is that?
Well, they're plus their fabric. They're just like
They prefer something like velour. Or something.
Oh yeah. Carpeting $100 a yard and fabrics $75-$80 a yard, things like that. Custom designed carpeting, custom dyed carpeting, and usually they have a budget, but they're usually pretty liberal.
Yeah. So you'd have to work with specialty fabric and dye houses, then, wouldn't you?
That's right. Yeah.
Special lighting.
Right. There are certain companies that make that make aircraft lighting. You work with them. You have a list of suppliers that do make standard items in lighting, like your ashtrays, your drink holders, and coat closet telescoping racks, things like that. Very expensive things, but
there's a minimum of space for things.
Oh yeah.
So you have to be rather ingenious, don't you? Come up with
interior. You have to make everything count.
Luxurious yet compact.
Right. And fine woods. They like burled walnuts and
oak.
Some oak. The wall coverings are usually custom. They don't use too many drapes anymore, or curtains. This one right here, like this, for instance, this Boeing, we used levelers in there. It's the
The
little mini blinds.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
how about tinted glass? Did they
some have tinted, yes.
Portholes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
Kitchen, elaborate kitchens, or at least
galleys.
Galleys, right. Yeah.
And they're more microwaved and mm-hmm. refrigerated,
right.
And there are standard. Components that you buy and install and things.
How about stereo and television?
Mm-hmm.
Staples?
Stereo, television, telephones.
And it'll all be sort of compacted into the bulkhead, I suppose.
Yeah, well, or in your consoles, or
that's
along
right.
the side, or in your seats, or whatever. The seats are bought from seat supply houses that do airplane seats.
Special line for you,
and you specify the fabric covering and styling. Sofas are the same way.
It's true by the fact you didn't use much leather. I wonder why.
Well, leather is a little too sporty. I mean, for executive.
Who is it?
Derek Grant.
Who is it?
Sometimes the leather is specified. If the customer happens to really like leather, you'll put a couple of leather seats in there, maybe something like that. But normally these interiors are very plush and very very homey.
I see.
It's hard to have occasional leather chair like I got.
Yes.
I have one leather chair in here, but I don't have my sofas and everything leather. But it's very very interesting work, and we sometimes travel. The airplanes are not always built in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these things, airplanes that we've done, were built in Los Angeles at the Jet Center. Occasionally they're built out of town in Kansas City or Texas.
What about sleeping accommodations? Obviously, you had to pack those into the rear of the fuselage.
Well, it depends on the floor plan, your layout. You can have your if it's a big enough airplane, you have the bedroom, any place that the thing works out. You have regular bedrooms. You have one bedroom, two bedrooms sometimes.
Yeah.
The smaller airplanes, of course, don't have beds. They have you don't use them on extended trips. You know, a G3 or G2 or something like that. That's from here to Chicago or something. You don't need to go to bed.
Yeah.
But for bedrooms, that's mostly in the large airplanes where you're traveling. Here to Europe or something,
right,
from Hong Kong or from Saudi Arabia to London, or
yes,
back and forth, something like that. Then they will specify a bedroom.
Have you ever done any large corporate jets, like Ford or others?
Well, these are all corporate jets.
Yeah.
But let's say we haven't done any for Ford Motor, no.
Mm-hmm.
But we've done none for the automobile companies.
Must have been very successful ending to your, not an ending really, it's still going on, very successful.
That was kind of sputtering along now.
tail ending on. In the time we've got left, Mr. Miller, which is about 5 minutes or so, can you sort of sum up your design career and philosophy as to, what you think you accomplished in the sense of a personal accomplishment? What impact you had on design in the various areas that you worked, and what's the future for industrial and automotive design in the next decades into the 21st century? That's a rather tall order. I've been throwing a curve at you. Just sort of free associate.
Well, starting the back first, I think there is a great future in industrial design, and automobiles are just one phase of industrial design, of course.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know whether what the future of automobile design, whether it'll be as and I say it's narrowed down now. It's narrowing all the time. It used to be that you had a lot of horizons in automobile design.
Yeah.
You went through phases. You went through the streamline phase. You went through the fin phase. You went through the rocket stage. Now you're into the sort of the industrial design or the appliance stage. Automobiles are getting smaller, they're getting tighter, they're getting more compact. They are getting truly aerodynamic without false design, like putting spinners on the front of the car.
Yes.
I don't make them go faster, but if you know, but if you nose the car down in front, have a wedge shape, then you have better aerodynamics. They do that now. They're all doing that. They're getting so they all look alike. I would like to buy a new car, but I don't know what I would want right now. There's nothing that turns me on. Mm-hmm. No? Mm-hmm. There's no car that makes me want to go out and spend my money on, or there's no car that I feel that I have to have. There have been several cars in my time that I thought I would have to have, and I usually had them. But
what do you drive today?
Well, we have we have three collector cars. We have a 64 and a half Mustang, is this one I do too. So we do drive that as a driver sometimes, but most of the times we drive our little Pinto station wagon.
Whoa.
It's a 1975 Pinto station wagon. It's got 130,000 miles on it, and it still runs very well.
Wonderful.
It's a great little car.
Mm-hmm.
And it still looks good. It still looks like a modern automobile.
Right.
So there's no great pressure on us to go out and buy something, but it's not going to run forever, so we're going to have to make up our mind one of these days to do it. But anyway, as I say, I'm not